Welcome back to the program. Suppose everything we've been told about sexual relationships and about monogamy was wrong. What if the whole idea of the nuclear family narrative were inconsistent with science, and we were given a bold alternative that really did take into account human history and biology? These are just some of the ideas put forth by my guest Christopher Ryan in his new book, Sex at Dawn. It's been called the single most important book about human sexuality since Kinsey, and it is my pleasure to welcome Christopher Ryan here this morning to talk about Sex at Dawn, the Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality. Christopher Ryan, thanks so much for joining us.
That's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. I want to start with the premise of the book that has certainly gotten arguably the most attention, which is that contrary to what we have heard for all of these years, that monogamy is not necessarily our natural condition.
Yeah, it's quite clearly not our natural condition. If by natural condition we mean most congruent with our biological impulses. Of course, when you're talking about human beings, natural is a very loaded word because many would argue, accurately I believe, that it's natural for humans to be very adaptive, so we're constantly adapting to different situations. But underlying that adaptiveness, we have very deep biological drives that have to be taken into consideration.
And to the extent that we are just now kind of beginning to understand these biological drives and in some ways fighting them, what's changed in our society that brings this to the fore now in the 21st century?
That's a very good question. I would locate this conversation right alongside the wave, the very slow wave, crossing our culture in terms of interracial marriage and certainly the news of the day, same-sex marriage. I think that there's a very slowly growing willingness to recognize that certain aspects of human nature simply are what they are, and by resisting them and denying them, we make a bad situation worse. And in many cases, it's not even a bad situation in terms of sexuality, for example. It's certainly understandable that people would feel threatened because everyone wants more familial stability. Everyone wants children to be raised in the best possible situation. But by insisting that any impulse toward infidelity, for example, is a personal failure or a sign of a dysfunctional marriage, we actually cause far more problems than we avoid.
Mm-hmm. And to what extent has our attempt over the years, this kind of frenzied attempt to keep the nuclear family intact, to what extent has the pressure to do that finally become so intense that it's becoming virtually uncorked?
Well, the several different things have happened that have created this historical moment. One of them is that until relatively recently, male fidelity was not expected. It wasn't really part of the marital package, per se. Female fidelity was, and we argue in the book that female fidelity has been enforced brutally since our species began cultivating agricultural revolution about 10,000 years ago. But before that time, there was really no need to be concerned about female fidelity because paternity wasn't really an issue. There was no property to pass down to your son, so it didn't really matter if he was your son or not. But with the rise of women's rights in the 20th century, particularly in the post-World War II period in the 60s, what happened was instead of relaxing the restrictions on female sexuality to bring them into alignment with male sexuality, male sexual behavior, we as a culture chose to restrict male sexual behavior and our expectations of male fidelity to bring it into alignment with what we'd been expecting of females all this time. And that's not working very well.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we see the price that men are even willing to pay for that in terms of, in some cases, bringing down their entire careers.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, they're willing in one sense because obviously they do it. I saw in the news today, Tiger Woods had his worst professional score ever. You know, obviously something's not right in his, you know, he's a little unbalanced at the moment. But, you know, willingness will includes this sense of control. And I think that often what happens is a loss of control. It's, and, you know, and this control, I strongly believe that knowledge gives us power. I think most people would agree with that. So when we're instilled with false knowledge, it weakens us. And it is definitely, at least according to our findings, it's quite clearly false to insist that monogamy comes naturally to our species.
And talk about the historical underpinning of those findings.
In terms of historical research, we're looking at the period since the advent of agriculture about 10,000 years ago. That's generally considered the historical period. That's about when writing and record keeping started to come into the fore. But what we're really interested in this book is looking beyond that period, because the historical agricultural phase of human existence is really only about 5% at most of our time on Earth as a distinct modern species. So archaeologists and anthropologists argue that what they call anatomically modern human beings, so these are people who look just like us, have the same brain architecture as we do and so on, have existed for about 200,000 years. So it's very interesting to look at that 95% of our time as a species to try to get a deeper sense of what makes us human, what is human behavior, human sexuality, what is the most comfortable way for us to relate to each other sexually and socially. And that's what we did in Sex at Dawn.
Mm-hmm. To what extent has violence played a role in this?
Violence is a very contentious issue, especially if we're talking about intergroup violence, mm-hmm. Often called war. This is a very contentious debate in archaeology, which we sort of dipped our toe into in the book. What we argue in the book is what other people have argued as well, is that there's very little evidence for organized warfare between human groups prior to agriculture. And again, it's you know, the famous saying, follow the money. Always follow the money, and it'll show you what's really going on. Before agriculture, there really was no money. There was no property. There's no private property. There's no accumulated food because there's no harvesting. There's no land because people are nomadic. There's no not a lot of private personal property because you had to carry everything you own, so it didn't make sense to own much. So what we find is that in pre-agricultural societies, sharing is the modus operandi. Sharing is the central organizing principle of this band-level society that our ancestors lived in. Not because they're more noble than we are, simply because it's the best way of spreading risk. It's an insurance system. And so what you find is that where there's no property, there's no real strong sense of identity with a particular piece of land because people are nomadic, there's nothing really worth fighting over. So it makes perfect sense that we don't see organized evidence of organized warfare until the post-agricultural period, when people did have a lot to fight over.
And how has that impacted sexuality and relations between men and women as that changed, as we moved into an agricultural society?
Yes, that's the key point you're getting at here, because what happened was that for the first time, women became property, men's property. And we see that still today in Iran, where women are being buried in the desert and stoned to death. For what? For having had sex with someone that the state did not approve, right? So what happened was that when this very important notion of private property entered into human life, the only way to assure paternity was to have absolute control over women's sexual behavior. So you see in the Old Testament, for example, the famous passage, "Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife." We all know that, but follow that and read it in context, and you see it says, nor his house, nor his servants, nor his livestock, right? So the wife is just one of several possessions of this man that you shouldn't covet. You should go out and get your own possessions. So this is a crucial turning point in human history when women went from being co-equal, highly respected members of band-level society to being just another thing for a man to own and defend and fight over.
And, of course, that attitude went on for a very long time.
It's still going on today, sure. I mean, look at, you know, even American society. We pat ourselves on the back for being so advanced and egalitarian, but single mothers receive virtually no help from the society as a whole. So they're forced into a position where they have to barter their sexual fidelity for help from a man, financial help, emotional, psychological help, raising children, and so on. What you find in societies like Scandinavian countries, for example, where the government is much more supportive of single mothers and their children, is that far more people live together without being married, because marriage isn't seen as that essential financial guarantee for a woman. She doesn't need it. And that's much more of a reflection of our prehistoric conditions.
And to what extent does what we've heard with respect to evolutionary psychology, to what extent is that kind of not consistent with what we're talking about?
Well, evolutionary psychology is very interesting in terms of its methodology. Essentially, the idea of evolutionary psychology is that our minds and behavior are shaped by evolutionary forces just as much as our bodies have been, which so far so good. The problem is that what often happens when you get down into the weeds in evolutionary psychology is you find a lot of pretty obvious political posturing being wrapped up and presented as if it were science. And so that's led a lot of people to be very suspicious of the field in general, because so much of it is just shallow reasoning justifying the status quo, particularly in terms of, you know, men are superior to women and always have been and always will be, and, you know, the sort of double standard is often very supported in evolutionary psychology, at least the more popular versions.
Mm-hmm.
So in our book, we agree with some aspects, at least some of the methodology used in some of the more carefully conducted evolutionary psychology research, but in general, we disagree with most of the findings in terms of male-female relations.
Talk about some of those findings that you disagree with.
The essential narrative of evolutionary psychology is that men and women have not only divergent reproductive agendas, but conflicting reproductive agendas. So the idea is that it seems to make perfect sense that because women have what's known as minimal parental investment, so a woman looks at a sexual encounter and says, okay, I could get pregnant. That's 9 months out of my life right there. Then I'm going to have this infant to carry around and take care of for another few years. So she's going to be much more careful about sex and much more discriminating than the man will, because his minimal investment is a few minutes and that's it. And so it's something he can enter into at a much lower cost than she can. So therefore, from that seemingly logical presupposition, the whole idea that women are much less libidinous than men, that women are trading their fidelity for access to a man's resources and protection and so on, that whole narrative comes out of that one observation. But when you actually look at pre-agricultural societies, And when you look at the primates that are closest to human beings, the chimps and the bonobos, you find overwhelmingly that that's not really the way females approach sexuality. In fact, in all these cases, the primates and the pre-agricultural societies, we found a much a degree of female promiscuity and a casual approach to sexuality that completely blows that narrative out of the water and exposes it as projection.
And how did the mythology of that narrative become so ingrained in the broader social fabric?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say that one way that its appeal is that it reinforces what people already believe. So, you know, when you look at the history of science, you see that if an idea appeals to the rich and powerful members of society, it tends to get very popular very quickly. Whereas an idea that that threatens their status or their wealth or power or so on has a very hard time gaining a foothold. So, you know, if you tell a Victorian Englishman that obviously science has demonstrated that the Victorian Englishman is the superior form of human being on the planet, he's going to agree with you, as they did, including Darwin himself. Whereas if you tell him, sorry, there's nothing inherently superior about you to an Indian from Tierra del Fuego, they're going to find that very threatening and hard to believe. So part of it is the appeal, but the other way that this idea has really gained a lot of traction is through Darwin himself. Darwin was undoubtedly, and we certainly don't dispute his genius. He was a genius, he was a gentleman, he was a kind and wonderful man, but he really didn't know much about women or human sexuality. He married his first cousin when he was 29 years old. By all accounts, both of them were virgins. And she was very buttoned up and proper, as was he. And so his approach to sexuality came through his theories and this insistence on female sexual reticence, and it lives on today.
You talk about bonobos and chimpanzees as not being monogamous. What about those species that we do see pair bonding? What do we learn from them?
Well, first, it's important to distinguish between pair bonding and sexual monogamy, or another way of putting it would be between social monogamy and sexual monogamy. Mm-hmm. What we found in recent years is that almost all of the species that appear to be monogamous, which are socially monogamous because a pair bonds for a breeding season and they raise, normally they're birds, they raise a brood of hatchlings together and so on. Because of inexpensive DNA testing that's become available in the last 10 years or so, what we found is that although they're socially monogamous, very few of these species are actually sexually monogamous. So there is a pair, and the male does assist with raising the young, but that male is not necessarily the genetic father of those hatchlings. So actual long-term sexual monogamy in the animal world is exceedingly rare. Among apes, the only example is the gibbon, which is located in Southeast Asia and lives in small nuclear family groups spread out in the trees. They're very, as all monogamous creatures are, they're very asexual. In other words, not only monogamous animals, but almost all animals only have sex when the female is ovulating. Human beings, chimps, bonobos, and dolphins are among the few animals that have sex at any time, whether the female can get pregnant or not. that's a very significant difference in our sexual behavior from the norm.
Talk a little bit about how marriage fits into this equation.
Well, marriage, as Casilda and I, and my wife and co-author, envision it, is a relationship that is a sacred relationship, but it's not, in essence, a sexual relationship. And we argue that this is the big mistake that we're making in American society and in Western society in general, which is insisting upon this Hollywood fairy tale vision of marriage, which assumes everlasting passion and unwavering attraction and so on and so forth. And the fact is that that's just not the way we're designed as animals. And so, as I mentioned earlier, you arrive at this tragic point where married couples are blaming themselves or blaming each other or blaming their relationship for the fact that sexual passion fades over time between them. There's no reason to blame anyone for that. That's simply the way we are. That's the inevitable result of a conflict between a culture that insists on long-term sexual monogamy and a biology that is attracted to sexual novelty. So what we're hoping is that people will read our book and use the information as a way to develop a more realistic sense of what they can expect from marriage. And hopefully that will result in more stable marriages and fewer children dealing with the effects of unnecessary divorces and broken families.
Christopher Ryan, the book is Sex at Dawn, The Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality. Christopher, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.